Hi, I'm Gordon Lanphier, and welcome to the Real Finds podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Philip Gurley. Philip is the co-founder and chief strategy officer of Cofactor, an end-to-end hardware supply chain risk management platform, providing solutions for parts management, procurement, and storage for critical manufacturing. On the podcast, we discuss challenges in the logistics industry, onshoring, trade, and how Trump's tariff war may shape commercial real estate markets. Phil, thank you for hopping on the podcast today.
Yeah, pleasure to be here, Gordon. Pleasure to be here.
So one of the big things that we've been talking about just in generally on the podcast is trade. And how did you get into the world of trade, logistics, and kind of understanding how the process of how goods move around the world works?
Deeply accidentally. My background was absolutely nothing to do with any of the things that I am doing today. I had a background in arts and technology, the overlap of those things. You get a little bit too deep into it and you start saying, well, if I just made my own hardware, I could probably have a lot more reliable outcomes on the software side. And so me and my co-founder, Matthew, start working in hardware. You start making a server. People ask if you can do IoT stuff. Fast forward a couple of years, we had worked with a lot of very large companies, been through an acquisition, decided let's take a pass at manufacturing. We did not know what that was going to be. You start ordering stuff, you start figuring out supply chain, realizing that you have to manage tariffs and temporary import bonding, and all of a sudden you're just in it. And as we've scaled the company and we've grown, we've become an organization that works with critical industries, manages a lot of documentation necessary for duty drawback. So it's just kind of ended up being where we are living. It's the things that we need to think about actively to solve problems for our customers. Very accidentally wandered into this world.
So why are electronics in particular so supply chain sensitive?
Well, there are some realities about the distribution of manufacturing globally. So if you look at critical industries, if you look at aerospace, you look at satellites, you look at infrastructure, you can't use the same materials that you put in the cell phone. And that's for interference reasons. It's because of the amount of radiation that something receives, the amount of vibration that something receives. There are a lot of conditions that can negatively affect something that might be a very technologically advanced unit of technology, but all of a sudden when you put it in space, it has a lot harder time. And so what you're looking at is mature node electronics. And this is basically a density of the actual infrastructure of those electronics. Over the last 30 years, the materials that are critical to us building satellites, building rocket ships, building infrastructure, those are majority manufactured in China. And so this is of particular interest, of particular import to what's going on right now in global policy and how things are kind of shifting is, can you reliably make systems that are critical and have transparency and have a reliable supply chain? These are huge concerns. I think you can look at the drone ecosystem. You can look at cell modems and IoT and what matters. You're seeing a lot of US manufacturers popping up that are really just licensing the hardware designs and then the firmware to essentially take a Chinese product and then stand it up in a Western market so that it is available. All of this, any change, any shift in process, any change to your supply chain, that's process change. Process change is a nightmare. When you're dealing with commercial off-the-shelf materials, you're dealing with distribution channels, which is obfuscating your relationship to the manufacturer. It's just a really, really complex space with a lot of sort of nodes of interaction to get to an assembled system. And so it is electronic specifically, as opposed to a custom piece of hardware that you manufacture for a purpose. It's just a really, really fractured ecosystem where, especially if you're dealing with critical industries and you you need security around those components that go into those systems. It's just it's top of mind for a lot of organizations, and it's really scary because if you can't use that part that you designed into and then certified and qualified, with the U.S. government, you can't manufacture your thing, and then the outcomes financially for a business that's being hit with penalties for not being able to deliver on a government contract, these are huge deals. So it's just a particularly sticky subject when it comes to manufacturing.
How does an organization go about handling all these shifts right now and kind of managing their supply chains? Because it seems like, I work with a lot of organizations and many of them tend to be, I'd say, less sophisticated, but some of them in the pharmaceutical space are very sophisticated. And for them, their precursors, not all of them come from China, but most of them come from Asia in general. I would say overwhelmingly this last 90 days has been kind of crazy.
Yeah.
How does an organization handle this sort of rapid change? And are you guys finding productive solutions to kind of navigate these very turbulent waters?
So I've heard a lot of different approaches, depending on the stage of the company and the scale of the company. If you're looking at really high value, low volume, they're just shrugging this off, right? If you're trying to get a rocket ship made, if you're paying twice as much for the hardware, that's ultimately not the thing that's going to make or break your ability to get to space, right? If you're a medtech manufacturer, yeah, and you have a lot of SKUs and you are pumping many products into the market, I've heard the story of we're just going to absorb as much as we can. And then if the market won't bear it, we'll stop making it, which is spooky when it comes to medical technologies, things that might be life critical, yeah, where you're like, yeah, I know for you, that's just a product line that you're shutting down for a little while. What's that going to mean to the consumer, which is, a citizen of the United States who might rely on that hardware? There's really, really significant challenges, I think, where you've got tiered supply chain, which this gets a lot more opaque. So if you have a very complicated system, if you're making an airplane, there's millions of parts in that. They are nested in assemblies and sub-assemblies that you might never have needed to have visibility into that supply chain before, because it was really nice to get those processes off your books and into somebody else's back office. And that was lovely. And now we're seeing a shift, I think, of the most responsible organizations, where as opposed to shrugging it off or going like, look, someone's going to have to pay for it or we'll stop making it, you're seeing a change to what they consider to be risk. And I'm seeing leaders in obsolescence starting to be a lot more proactive about supply chain and thinking about the risk that they're sort of absorbing in their tiered supply and wanting a lot more transparency into that. And so I think in the same way that for a individual part saying, look, was it made in Taiwan or China? I need to know before I put it into a system. I think we're seeing like, look, I need to know if the box that I buy from you, what inside of that box is coming from China? What inside of that box has a long lead time? What inside of that box doesn't have quality documentation that's up to my standards? And I think that this is a shift from when will the thing no longer be available to is the thing available? Should I be using it? So there's a lot more expansion, I think, in what risk is. And the idea that supply chain is now an obsolescence story, because if you can't buy the thing, even if it's being manufactured, but you can't have it anymore, it's essentially for your build, that is an obsolescent part. And so that's an interesting kind of philosophical shift that I've seen. And I think it's also highlighted inside of organizations that design engineering functions. Design for manufacture used to not be sort of top of mind. And then a whole world of software and solutions came into being that said, actually in the engineering function, you should be thinking about manufacturing to some extent. And there's always going to be these passes and these checks. And when you reach out to your manufacturer, they're going to work with you on it. But design for supply chain, and that's kind of where we live. And I think that's the philosophical thing that we're pushing forward. It's the philosophical stance I think obsolescence leaders are starting to see, is that actually in the engineering function, it's not just designing. It's not just designing for manufacture. It's also designing for supply chain. And so we're seeing a lot more interplay between departments, and I think between organizations is where this is going to lead, where even if you're in a lower volume industry where maybe you don't have the same transparency that an Apple or a Google does into their manufacture, it's just going to become more demanded. It's going to become more expected so that you can assess your risk. And then however the sort of tides of policy or international trade goes, at least then you'll understand and be able to pull those levers responsibly.
How does one go about assessing that risk and like pulling those levers responsibly? Because, you know, that's all, there's a lot of factors involved. I know I'm working with one company that's a biopharmaceutical company that makes kind of precursors to a number of drugs that are used in the United States. And they were looking at their supply chain for some of the chemicals that they were getting. And they realized very quickly that, like, it wasn't the fact that one of their suppliers was located in China, but the problem was like one of their suppliers got their supplies from China, and right, that they're just hosed right now. Yep. And that they're totally reevaluating their supply chain as a result. How can a company navigate that? Because it seems like it's incredibly complex for even the sharpest mind to kind of wrap their heads around.
It is. I think it's I mean, I hate to use a phrase like this, but it's kind of just shaking down the suppliers and saying, look, I know that we've had don't ask, don't tell to some extent about how we are getting these materials or how we're getting these assemblies. Or I think that that's just changing. It's changing rapidly. And one of the interesting sort of models that we're looking at of how do you not just make this vendor communication, right? Because this is it a procurement function? Is it an obsolescence, a supply chain function? Like, who's the one that's supposed to be tracking this down? And so one of the things that we've been talking about is how do you maintain IP while still understanding risk if you are the buyer? And we've been having conversations about, okay, if we can access your designs and your bills of material and then index against the industry, the sort of broader database of supply data, can we just highlight the points of risk as you would internally, understanding, look, this is long lead, this is maybe coming from a source that's not approved for export control reasons or just, you know, general political reasons or safety. Can we just surface that risk so that a buyer can understand, well, the risk profile of this product is 6 out of 1,004 parts. And what is the level of risk? Can we highlight what that risk is and then work with that vendor to kind of diminish the risk to the lowest point possible and then at least responsibly buy, right? I think there's some other issues in here where, especially in these complex systems, if you have an error in the field, forward and backwards traceability, if you don't have access to that data. So I think that there's interesting models and we're working in this. I know that there's some other sort of startups and organizations that are thinking about this, but it's like, how do you maintain a healthy relationship? How do you maintain intellectual property? But then if you have an error or an issue or a point of risk in that tiered supply chain, how do you create transparency around that so that you can make better decisions strategically as an organization? And then hand in hand with that, make sure that maintenance and repair can happen really, really quickly if there is an error. And so it's really about creating a digital thread that kind of connects these tiered supplies in a way that doesn't endanger and isn't just endless phone calls and beating everybody up on give me more data and send me another spreadsheet. So I think there's some interesting experiments and models and kind of thoughts going into this right now. From what I've seen, other than the sort of largest, most scaled manufacturers that have built this up internally over decades, it's right now a bit of a Wild West space.
So going into the Wild West space, the solution to many is tech, right? Is that there's a tech solution to try to navigate this because the human mind can only follow so many threads. And even if, you know, we're putting everything down on paper, we can really only monitor so many threads in real time, right? As you talked about. So you guys have some solutions to this problem. What are you seeing in the market as the most effective solution? And you know, you can talk about your own as well and kind of how you're deploying it.
Yeah. So I mean, so we work in critical industries. So we're GovCloud, we're ITAR registered, compliant. So we have kind of a little bit of a different universe in this, in that our customer base is very, very, very data sensitive. That a lot of the documents that we deal with are export controlled and need to be managed in a different way than, you know, a consumer good would be handled. I mean, the stuff that we're doing is utilizing essentially light AI clients running on GovCloud to then take in a lot of this data and manage emails, manage POs, manage invoices, track materials, absorb bills of material and design documents. And then anytime that we need to reach out to the broader sort of ecosystem of the internet, you know, using an LLM or referencing an external API, we're just obfuscating and sort of hashing out any of the sensitive data after parsing it all apart. And then we reabsorb whatever that response is in an anticipated JSON format. So you can't do code injection. So there's no risk, there's no exposure, right? And like, that's a very specific model is, okay, how do we take what we know internally, compare it with what we know externally, and then sort of get best outcomes out of that? So that's like what we're dealing with. But I think it's like, if you look at any of the companies in the supply chain space right now, they're pushing AI in a million different ways. And depending on the risk profile of the company or the sort of willingness to adopt new technologies inside of the reality that, you know, I think in manufacturing and in supply chain, you can't have hallucination, right? And that's the big focus on us is like, it has to be deterministic. It has to be, if you ask it the same question twice, you need the same answer both times, right? And you need it to be accurate. So that's really what we're focused on. But I think it is, how can you leverage new technologies in a way that gives you like 100% successful deterministic outcomes and automate as much of the sort of redundant stuff, right? Like you don't need an inbox that's getting slammed with 1,000 updates that in fact your order is running on time or that you have received the material in the time frame that you expected, right? I think it's more about where can you solve those really direct, simple problems that is the mundane, and then highlight, hey, this is actually outside the norm. Something unexpected has happened. And so any of the application, I believe, is really just about how can you reliably solve the simple problems so that the more complex, more heady, more strategic stuff at least gets pushed to the surface without any of the other noise. And that's kind of how we think about it, is like, don't be big and fancy. Be practical and let people focus on the stuff that matters.
So one of the practical things and the things that's going to matter for, I would say, probably 80% of the people listening to this podcast is they're going to be listening to try to get little insights into how the real estate world is reacting to some of these supply chain shocks. I know in the last 90 days, we've had more LOIs fall through and not have purchase sale agreements or leases than probably any other time in my career. There's a lot of instability in general, and people are looking for any indicator that they can to latch on to either optimizing their occupier decisions or optimizing their decisions investing, particularly in the industrial sector. And so I'm curious kind of what you're seeing and how you're seeing it play out from your perspective, as somebody who's really on the ground, seeing how the supply chains are functioning or not functioning.
I mean, again, I think our stance, right? Like, so we work with a lot of like economic development groups. We're dealing with like A&D, and I think that ecosystem is a little bit more driven either by pretty tight government contracts and an absolute requirement to deliver, or by a bunch of VC, because we're not working with like the sort of incumbent Andy space. We're very much so in the up and coming, the recent receivers of some of those larger grants, and then aerospace, robotics, and in that space, I mean, the facilities that are being built are monumental. The deals that are being signed are huge, and they're happening in places like Texas, and they're happening in places like Ohio, and they're, you know, like, it's like data center and manufacturing is kind of the space. And so that's like, yep, we're buying 1 million acres in Virginia and we're transforming a community, right? And so I probably have a bit of a stilted sort of approach to this, because I think that that more sort of I'm going to call it like linear growth and a more paced sort of risk aversion and understanding, going like, okay, am I making the right decision? In a lot of the customers that we're working with, they're pulling the trigger on big moves, and these are near tidal forces, right? And so, I mean, I'd be super interested to hear what you're seeing and what you're experiencing, because I'm sure that it's a different universe than what I'm exposed to.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you from what we're seeing generally is some of the higher margin businesses are really not seeing that much of a shock, particularly because we're on a pause right now, and this podcast will go out before that pause ends. The second thing that we're seeing generally is, you know, the tariffs that were in place for some of the countries that aren't China really even weren't that big relative to the totality of a lot of the products involved. And so as a consequence, most of the individuals that we work with that aren't getting a large percentage of their product from China, even if it's from other countries with relatively high tariffs, are able to manage it, and it's just causing prices to go up a little bit. Some of the China low margin, or some of the just extremely low margin product that's come from Mexico, there is a little bit of turbulence, and I think that's caused people to delay decision making as a whole, but it hasn't stopped the market. This isn't like what the market was for office for the first 6 months of COVID, where everyone right. was just an absolutely sheer free fall. I'm kind of curious to see, though, even from some of those large projects, though, if you have run into any issues that you've seen with the supply chain. Because I know, like, for us, some of the issues have been things that we didn't originally think were going to be big issues. Like, for example, paper and wood products have been a huge issue with Canada. Mm-hmm. For many of our suppliers, particularly in packaging. I'm curious what you're seeing, maybe from some of the larger suppliers, particularly who are building things out or are working in robotics or highly sensitive areas where there might not be a whole lot of places to go in terms of a supply chain.
Yeah, I mean, I'll use sort of an example of a customer that we were supporting. I mean, there's a lot of unexpected behavior in that we as a nation and sort of our stances fluctuated, right? Like I think independent of your political beliefs or background, certainly the last few months have had a lot of variation in how we are approaching trade.
That's pretty fair. Yeah.
Yeah. And then yeah. Meanwhile, you know, I think other nations have basically been like, we have our policy. We will continue to have our policy. And there's been some sort of, I would say, not great outcomes in that, like Chinese steel, I think, is just getting more subsidized by the state right now, by the Chinese state. Like if you're making robotics and you need a large chassis, China is still incredibly competitive, even with the fluctuation in tariff, because they can just subsidize their own steel costs. And so they can still knock those costs down. And they've done such a great job of building up manufacturing ecosystems that's they're still, as far as the quote goes, they're still going to come in really, really, really competitive. And so something that we're seeing, at least in the higher value sort of assemblies, is a desire to nearshore or onshore those processes, to know that you're not going to have policy change your unit economics, especially if you're dealing with like robotics as a service or something like that, where sort of your product in the field, there's a time to recoup the value before you see profitability on that. So there's the idea that your unit cost might go up by 25%. That could actually kill your bottom line, right? Like sort of eliminate your feasibility as a business model. And so while there's that desire, there's a lot of hunger to kind of shore up that supply chain, to get it inside of the United States, to reliably build the infrastructure, or utilize the infrastructure that is domestic. But China can just keep undercutting costs. And there's some trends in consumer goods that I think are kind of unnerving, where you've seen sort of exception for tariffs on some of the consumer electronics that previously, at least an amount of manufacturing was being done domestically, and that supports manufacturing facilities, growth of teams. Like, I think if you look at the R&D departments of some of the larger tech giants, the trend seems to be that the more appealing offer is to just push everything, design, quality, test, NPI through production entirely to the Eastern market, because the irregularity of the unit economics of even the sort of early design processes being domestic makes them untenable. And so there's a lot of challenges where there's a lot of interest. I think there's a desire to have a more resilient onshore manufacturing ecosystem to normalize some of those costs. But there is so much manufacturing force in Taiwan and South Korea and China and Japan that it's really difficult from a bottom line, from a business standpoint, to drift from those environments.
Yeah, I know from us, in many of the conversations we've had with some of our occupiers, I think some of the saddest aspects of the Trump policy has been, we started to see a substantial amount of nearshoring, not necessarily to the United States, but a lot to Mexico. Particularly, you know, we're in the Chicago, area, and so it's Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois, and there's a strong railroad network up through the Midwest into Chicago. And as a result, Mexico was a very desirable location to put some of the lesser skilled labor, and then mainly finishing off product in the United States. And we've seen with the transition that increasingly that process has gone on pause in Mexico, and as a result, gone on pause in the United States as well. I'm curious how you've seen the tariffs play out with nearshoring generally, and how you're seeing it in generally your portfolio of clients.
Yeah, I mean, it's nearshoring also feels risky now, which is a bummer, because especially if you look at Mexico, especially over the last decade, we have done a huge amount of infrastructure investment in Mexico. And those facilities are often run by U.S. citizens living in Mexico. And so to create an adversarial relationship where you're looking at a decade plus of investment and time and strategy, and like, how do you create an economy? How do you compete in this economy? What is a good choice of investment, right? And I think you sort of see almost the inverse in Canada. A lot of that infrastructure has been there for decades, that it started off with companies like GE coming in and building infrastructure inside of Canada, and then sort of allowing that to be turned over to Canadian companies and sort of run that process. So you're looking at the sort of generational challenge of, you know, maybe your grandfather worked in Canada and your grandson works in Mexico, and you're like, oh no, this is a beautiful ecosystem of manufacturing that we've built over decades to create a more resilient North American economy. And now those are both risks, and those are adversarial relationships potentially. And it's tragic, because because those decades are decades spent, and you can't just shift that. You can't just magically make manufacturing appear. You can't make sourcing appear out of nothing. That those decades of effort are decades that we are now going to have to spend inside of the borders of the United States to even reach parity with what we've historically invested in. It's a really, really challenging environment. And the duty drawback and stuff like that, there's like ways that you can manage this where at least you're only paying tariffs on the sort of initial product, right? And so that can avoid some of that international trade, but it's still challenging.
Can you dive into that a little bit more, how the duty drawback works for somebody who might be listening and doesn't fully understand?
Yeah. So if I, if I buy something from Taiwan and it lands in the United States and then I ship it to Mexico and then they create a subassembly in Mexico and then they ship that back to the United States, there's a couple times in there that tariffs would be paid because you're moving things between. When something is consumed or destroyed in the manufacturing process, so basically it has become part of another assembly, that should basically reduce the cost of the tariffs paid. And so you only pay the tariffs one time instead of repeatedly. And what you need to do to make that work is you need really meticulous documentation of the materials and where they've gone and what they've done, which like that story, again, this was like, we built a digital platform for it. So that's been an interesting, we just have that documentation, but that's a super challenging thing to do. And so there is a little bit of sensationalism when someone says to make a car, you're going to have to pay five times as much as the car because of the tariffs of moving materials between Mexico and the US and Canada and da, da, da. There are, opportunities to get those dollars back as an organization, but the documentation is very, very challenging. You just have to do the paperwork with the United States to get that money back, and you still have to pay that money up front. You still have to pay the tariffs to get the materials released from customs. And so it's a big capital expense. You're less liquid because of this. But there are at least methodologies to manage it. It's just, again, it's a sort of back office process and who's managing this paperwork and do you have the infrastructure in place or do you go to a broker that manages this for you? So it's all just process change and super, super difficult.
So in terms of process change, one of the things we'd like to talk about before we wrap up is in this, like, and I hate using this term, but you know, it's such an effective term, in the new normal of, mm-hmm. you know, the new
age, whatever, whatever, trade,
whatever. I mean, it's such whatever. A silly way of whatever, right? In terms of that, when we're doing this, what's the best way that a business is sitting there can manage the risk that's inherent in kind of this new age of trade? And kind of, are there some geopolitical lessons that we can learn to kind of how you can behave as someone who's bringing goods into the country, or are we just rolling the dice?
This is not a new thing, right? We're like, oh my God, what's happening? What's happening to the whole world? Supply chain, it's nightmarish. It's been a whole 9 minutes since COVID happened and we were in another horrible supply chain environment. You go back,
a
one
new,
of my favorite...
A new normal.
A yes. new yes. normal, right? And yes, there's when VCRs got super popular, they stripped a bunch of electronic components from the market, and all of a sudden we were in a supply chain nightmare because VCRs were hot. Like, there have been so many iterations of this, and I think the lesson that we have to take is it is really appealing to pass off the responsibility of your supply chain onto a tiered vendor. It is really appealing to say, I've got my vendor and my job is just to beat up that vendor on price. And if the quality drops, I will yell at them to get the quality back up. Supply and procurement, these are processes that have to sort of be continuously improved, right? And I think continuous improvement and diversifying your supplier base, understanding the risk, right? Saying it's the same way that people handle inventory right now, right? If you have critical inventory, you don't put it all in one building, because if that building burns down, you are completely SOL, right? Like, you're just like, there is no hope. It's all gone. What do we do, right? There's no ramping back up. We've seen relationships with major, major manufacturers, like EMS providers, you know, like big, big companies where a organization, an OEM, is handed off to this, you know, electronics manufacturing service provider. Like, you're just going to do my box build. You're going to build my thing, and that's great. All of a sudden, demand fluctuates. They see a little fall off in how much they're delivering to that OEM, and they go, look, you're not a great customer anymore. We're firing you. That their entire supply chain, their entire process, the ability to deliver product is in the hand of one organization that just decided they don't want to play nice anymore. And that really scary possibility, I think, is where we've kind of pushed ourselves for the last 3 decades as a nation, which is like, we're a services country. We're the thinkers. We're not the doers. No, pass it off to somebody else. Like, and if I can only have one person I got to call And I say 1,000, please. And then they send me 1,000 of the thing. That's great. And that's just not, it's not a healthy way to do business. It's not a healthy way to manage your risk. So I think this like continuous evaluation of your supply chain, multi-sourcing opportunities, continuing to do check-ins to distribute your supply chain to understand, look, it's, I can't just have it come from Europe. I can't just have it come from Mexico. I can't just have it come from China. I can't just have it come from the US. Kind of need that opportunity across the board. And you could see some of this happen like in avionics. Like this is already like, if you look at what goes into an airplane, a lot of these manufacturers have diversified where they actually manufacture the sub-assemblies. And I think that every company has to start thinking a little bit more like this. It's the, you can't just find the your one or your five vendors and rely on them and just say, that's it, it's short up. Less points of failure is good. It's like, you actually need to kind of pivot your thought and say, I need more of a network here. I need more optionality. And I need to continuously communicate, whether through technology or directly, on what are the risks of these vendors.
There's a chemical company I'm working with in the transportation industry broadly, both aviation and just transportation, that is in the process of doing this as well. They had one site location and now they're going to three. And it's just because of just generally the market, they don't feel safe being a relatively critical chemical company. And, you know, if a lab blows up somewhere, they're done. So, right. In terms of that, we don't want to blow up this interview, but you know, we, at the same time, we'd like to kind of go into our final four, and it's always kind of like a fun last little wrap up, and it's a way to learn a little bit more about you and learn a little bit more about kind of where you think trade's going, logistics, procurement, and so one of the first questions we always like to ask. And this is, you know, let's put on our little Nostradamus cap. Where do we think the future's going of trade, logistics, and manufacturing over the next 10 years?
So I think it's been kind of what we're hinting at here the whole time, which is it's going to be more transparency and it's got to be more collaboration. And it has to be more optionality. I think the thing that is going to become forefront of sort of a lot of people's mind is if something goes wrong, how, why, right? Like what happened here? And we're not going to have less complex supply chains. We're not going to have less tiered manufacturing. Specialization exists for a really, really good reason. And it's because you should not know how to, if you're building a drone, you should not necessarily have a five axis CNC machine that's cutting up a bunch of steel, right? Like that, or aluminum. It doesn't make any sense. And so it's going to be, I think, more connectivity. It's going to be more data moving between organizations, more automation and more link. And this is, I think, the provenance of materials. I think that this is quality documentation. This is test documentation. We're already looking at models where I think when you're doing supplier discovery and maybe you're a smaller company and you've lost a vendor because of trade issues, there's a follow the leader narrative, right? And so you want to go, okay, well, who's already working with companies that I respect, right? Because then I want to track them down. Already, if you go to supply chain leadership, it's like, well, I've got a great guy in Taiwan. Okay, that information I think has to become more readily available, and everyone will always have their personal relationships, but understanding why a vendor is quality, what their processes are, knowing that they'll be transparent, open and honest with you, understanding the risk profile, like these are all things that I think lead to a more interconnected manufacturing and supply chain industry. Where if something goes wrong, you have forward and backwards traceability, you understand the financial implication, you understand the risk before you are building that thing, and you can execute in a lot more elegant and successful way.
Yeah. I think transparency is great. It's definitely, I don't know if it's definitely, but hopefully it's the future. In terms of that, we've gone to the future, and now we're going to take a step back in time. We have a lot of folks that listen to this podcast that are somewhere in the first 10 years of their career, and that they're sitting there listening. And I'm curious if you could give one little bit of advice. It could be very short, but what would you give to yourself at the start of your career?
Everything you do is a product. Anything that you're doing, whatever it is, think of it as a product. Try to make it a product. I did a lot of really, really interesting projects that I thought were great and a lot of fun, and then realized a few years later that that's what engineers get paid to do. And that, in fact, everything that I had done could have probably been a product if I had put like 8% more effort into it. And so, you know, as you jump in and you try something out, I think, you know, whatever you're doing today, it's interesting, it's fun, it's engaging, it's new. Is it repeatable? And this is something like, can you repeat this motion? Can you repeat this offering? Can you scale this product? Can you provide it to more people? I wish someone had like cued me in on that a little bit earlier in life.
Developing systems is definitely the key to developing scale and growing. One of the ways that we like to grow as well is we like to look and see kind of what people who are in the arena are reading. If you're a reader at all, is there a book that you would recommend to our audience?
Yeah, totally. So two of them are funky, and one of them is incredibly obvious. So,
that's totally fine. We can get funky on here. So that's not a problem.
Okay, there is a great Finite and Infinite Games by James Karst. It starts off and it's very, very simple. It goes, to play a game, you must be willing to play. No one can be forced to play. Play is a state of choosing to do something. And then it evolves in a very unexpected direction where it tears apart these ideas of how you engage with like a game, how you play games in your life, what that means to our society. It's a really interesting take on sort of how we interact with each other and how we overcome challenges and what are the personal and the moral implications of that. So Finite and Infinite Games really does not end the way it starts. Totally worth the ride. Rules of Play is another one. Rules of Play, it's a textbook technically, but it's just interesting. Again, it kind of breaks down the concept of engagement and how you work with someone. And again, these are like, it's like game theory, but what is not game theory, right?
It's like, yeah.
It's big stuff, right? You're like, oh, it's all these things. Like we are all playing with each other. We are all choosing to show up every day. So Rules of Play is another really interesting one. Again, it just sort of breaks down a lot of concepts that I think are really useful. And this kind of ladders into the much more expected outcome as a book that I think everyone should read, which is Radical Candor. And Radical Candor by Kim Scott, it's really easy to have successful communication that is slightly unhealthy or maybe too sympathetic, too soft. It's hard to be really honest and really direct. It's really difficult, especially to build a culture around you that's honest and direct and can kind of detach the idea of expected outcomes from emotions. And I think that Radical Candor is just it's a great book to read with a team as you're growing a culture for yourself and how you interact with the world. I think directness without cruelty is a really, really valuable and important thing.
So I'll be direct and take some radical candor here. And the whole reason for this podcast, the reason why we have you on today, beyond all your knowledge, is ultimately we value this podcast because we find it's a great way to get other recommendations of other intelligent, thoughtful men and women in the arena. And so I'm curious, who's the next person that we should have on the podcast?
So, I mean, this is more of a general direction, but I swear, I think economic development groups, man, they are the ones. Like they are on the ground floor. They are talking to the companies that are moving and building facilities. They understand the ecosystems that they are playing in. I mean, we're talking to NEO, which is in Ohio, the northeastern region of Ohio. Super smart people, grounded, relatable, connected to a community, but they're building infrastructure and they know what it takes on the ground to get it done. and they are talking to some of the biggest companies in the country and the world on, hey, do you want to build here? And I think if you went and knocked on the doors in Virginia or in Ohio or in Texas, I mean, these are environments where there is a lot going on. It is exciting. It is highly cost competitive versus some of the other hubs of manufacturing. If you look at the Northeast or Silicon Valley, things like that. So, I mean, those are the doors I would go and knock on to say, hey, what's going to be happening in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
I think that's great advice. Now, there's one final question, and that's simply, if somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to get in contact?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, our website, cofactor.com, cofactr.com, is a great way. You can email me directly, Phil, Phil, Phil@cofactor.com, or LinkedIn. LinkedIn's great. I'm Philip Gulley, Philip Gulley, on LinkedIn. And you know, those are all wonderful ways for us to start chatting.
Phil, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And we have to have you on in the future.
Yeah, this was a pleasure. Thanks so much, Gordon.
Thanks again to Philip. We appreciate his insights. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear, The Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.